One of the main conflicts that we have with the culture in which we live in is the pursuit of truth. What is true? What is not true? There are lots of lies that we have to sort through, whether they be political or just social or just in terms of interpersonal relationships. Truth is at the heart of a lot of these areas that we struggle with. And in fact, that was one of the first issues. Actually, it was the first issue in the Garden of Eden. Did God really say what he said was part of the temptation of Eve? So truth is very, very important. And even in the area of science. So what is true? And in the area of science, there's a conflict in our culture with what we believe the Bible teaches. And there's a lot of confusion, even amongst Christians, because they don't know the truth. So one of the things I want to do today is to give you what I think Genesis 1 teaches concerning areas of science. So if you have an outline sheet, I'm going to just continue where we left off last time. And I plan on giving you a brief review, and then we'll get into day 5. We looked at day 4 last time, part of the review. There was a little part at the end that I didn't quite get to that we'll pick up as part of the introduction. Then we'll look at day 5, and then we'll look at day 6 is the plan, or at least the first part. We won't get into the creation of man. Man is created on day 6. But we'll get up to, hopefully, close to that time. We can't overemphasize the fact that this is the most important book ever written, the book of Genesis. I agree with Henry Morris. It lays the foundation to everything, and particularly the foundation for all of truth. We have the beginnings of what God has revealed as absolute truth. Now, we come into conflict, even in the area of science or interpreting what is the meaning, what is real in terms of the natural realm. So there is interpretation that is involved and trying to sort out reality, what is true, what is not true. That's the endeavor of science. Unfortunately, modern science has degenerated from its original modern science origins, such that today science is dominated by what is called methodological naturalism. I told you about this last time, just a quick review. Methodological naturalism basically omits anything, any idea that comes outside of understanding what you can actually observe in the natural realm. So methodological naturalism imposes naturalistic theory on interpreting the things that you observe in science. If your conclusions don't match what you can observe, then it is omitted. So any other sources of truth outside of the natural realm is automatically dismissed. So particularly in the area of historical science, it tries to reconstruct ancient events. If you come to a conclusion that the data itself cannot give you, then you omit it. So you omit anything that comes outside of the natural realm, which means you omit what the Bible has to say, revelation. And then you, if you're a believer and you believe that God is creator, you believe the early chapters of Genesis, well, science seems to have concluded these things from this naturalistic perspective. Well, how do we match the text to be in line with what science has concluded? Well, all attempts really attempt to harmonize the text, and it's the biblical text that suffers and, in fact, is distorted. But there's a different way of approaching all of the areas, of particularly even science. From a biblical worldview, we talked about this as well, you begin with Scripture. So we're going to begin with the very beginning, Genesis 1. What does it teach us? And then from it, we avoid these unbelieving worldview influences concerning naturalism, because the world we live in now is not the same world that existed at the original creation. Therefore, even science is different in terms of Genesis 1. I think it was radically affected by the fall, and then secondly, radically affected by the flood as well. So we're removed at least in two major events recorded in the Bible that are rejected by naturalistic theologians or historians. So we avoid those unbelieving worldviews, and now with this biblical foundation, we have a perspective or a foundation to be able to interpret the physical data. So that's what we'll do with the book of Genesis. We'll let it speak and then understand the natural realm from that perspective. So last time I gave you an introduction that included a review of days 1 and 2. Then we focused on day 3. So day 3 deals with the creation of the land, or the separating from the land, from the waters. There's two creative events, and also the creation of plant life. And just a summary of it, the earth brought forth vegetation, plants yielding seed after their kind. We looked at the details there, getting into genetics. Trees bearing fruit with seed in them after their kind. Another emphasis on genetics. And God saw that it was good, so it was very good. Today, that is not so. We don't live in a very good creation anymore. So we looked at a little bit of a science, at least on a broad basis. We talked about plants entering into a process called photosynthesis. You can break this down into an equation, and we looked at the details of it. And one of the conclusions that we came to is photosynthesis is one of the most important chemical reactions on Earth. And in fact, we see lots of contradictions with a naturalistic understanding of the natural realm. For example, evolution says that life began in a primordial soup or an ocean, but Genesis tells us vegetation comes from the land, not from the oceans. So a summary of some of the science we touched on day 3, we have the origin of geophysics and tectonics. We also talked about botany and genetics and the emphasis from the land again. We mentioned the fixity of kinds. Plant life is created in categories that are distinct from one another, different kinds. So they're fixed. That's the genetic aspect, no evolution. We also talk about the origin of food and oxygen factories that are preparing for animal life that we'll see in day 5. We said that vegetation comes before sunlight, out of sequence again with the evolutionary interpretation. Fruit trees before animals, another contradiction. In fact, we're going to focus on lots of other contradictions with the common understanding of our culture about origins, which involves evolution. And we said that this is a total work of God, no naturalism in Genesis 1, God's creative hand at work in 6 creative days. Then we focused on day 4, where we have celestial bodies, verses 14 through 19. And some of the science that we emphasized here is light is created before stars. Stars are created on day 4, whereas light is created on day 1. So totally out of sequence with the evolutionary scheme. Secondly, we mentioned that the Earth comes before the sun, stars, and galaxies. Again, a very drastic contradiction with evolutionary theory. So don't try to harmonize evolutionary ideas or current thinking in any area of science, whether it be biology or astrophysics. Don't try to harmonize it with the biblical text, because you will not come to the right conclusions. Because we believe that the biblical text is absolute truth. Now, it doesn't mean that we always understand it, But at least we have contained within the Scriptures absolute truth, and we seek to understand it with proper interpretive principles. Thirdly, we have the origin of the stars on day four. No pre-existing stars, which evolutionists believe in. Heavenly bodies on day four, not early, not day one, not early, but later in terms of God's creative hand. And we might say that we have the origin of the whole area and study of astronomy laid out after day four. And that's about where we left off last time. There was one other thing that I wanted to alert you concerning even believers that are from the scientific community. Some of them are highly influenced by naturalistic theory. They're trying to accommodate and try to fit the Bible into what they think science teaches. And there is a commentary out there by an individual I'll mention in a moment. And as I was reading his commentary on the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis, I began to notice kind of some patterns as he went through the different passages. And these patterns, actually, it kind of struck me. This is what those who try to accommodate the biblical text with current so-called scientific theories, one of the first things they do is they emphasize the supporting details in the text. In other words, they'll go into some detail of explanation, emphasizing the details that support current thinking or some ideas of science, and particularly evolutionary thinking. Second thing they do is they superimpose these current supposed conclusions of science, and we're talking about particularly historical science dealing with reconstructing the past. They superimpose those theories on the biblical text rather than the other way around. In other words, letting the biblical text interpret and help us and guide us in coming to conclusions. Thirdly, and this is what this commentary does, now he's forced to reinterpret the text. And I'm going to give you one example of how he does this, but you see this throughout because there's so many contradictions, there's so many inconsistencies. You have to somehow force the text to fit what they think is current science. And another fourth thing that they do is they ignore the non-supporting details that are contained in the text. And I notice that sometimes they'll just skip over entire phrases because they don't fit the current thinking. So beware of these accommodating commentaries. In fact, beware of any commentary that is on either the book of Genesis or the book of Revelation, as Mark will tell you, because they will come from a very different perspectives than understanding the Bible as authoritative, inerrant, and inspired. So Hugh Ross is the writer of that commentary I mentioned. And when it comes to day four, and this is a quote right out of his commentary, notice what he says, and you can probably pick out the inconsistency with what current science says. I've already pointed it out, and what the Bible teaches. He says, on creation day four, the sun and the moon and the stars became distinctively visible from Earth's surface for the first time. In other words, what is he assuming? He's assuming that the sun and the moon and the stars were created before the creation of the earth, in fact, very early. And now that the writer, or Moses, is telling us about the creation of the sun and the moon and the stars, he has to reinterpret and inject that into the text by saying now they became visible. And notice he says that they became distinctly visible from the surface for the first time. And he goes on and explains verse 16 is parenthetical, a parenthetical note. So he's kind of skipping over it. It's parenthetical, kind of ignore it. It's not part of what the focus of the text is all about. And when it talks about God placing the heavenly bodies in verse 17, these are echoes. In other words, kind of reminding us, echoes of the wording of day one. Well, you notice he's reinterpreting the biblical text because he has superimposed current thinking, and now he's forced to deal with the biblical text. So if you look at the details, we call them exegetical or interpretive details of the text, you see that we have the same pattern in day four as what we've seen in other days preceding. We have the divine fiat or the divine speaking. We have the same phraseology, and God said, and then he speaks, he articulates what he's going to create or what he is in the process of creating. So you don't see any difference. We have a sequence here of creative acts. And again, we have the immediacy of fulfillment in verse 15. In other words, no long periods of evolutionary time to get from the creation of stars and the sun and the moon, and then eventually, after long periods of time, eventually the earth. You have the immediacy of fulfillment. And you also have creation terms in verse 16. Terms that are common in Genesis 1 and common in terms of God's creation. And the main one here is kind of a synonym to bara. Bara is in the beginning, God created bara. That's a Hebrew word. And in general, I take it that God creates out of nothing, bara. And here, another creative word, almost a synonym, asah. Very similar. In fact, it's common in the Genesis account. So we have a creative act, and it's not much different than the first 3 days of creation in terms of God's action. And he also says that the sun and the moon appeared, and we don't have that word in the text here. The sun and the moon did not become visible or appeared. In fact, later on he uses the word the sun and the moon appeared on day four. But Moses could have very easily used that word because he used it in verse 9 when he talks about the land appearing. Remember, we talked about it. In fact, I call attention to it, if you remember. And that word is ra'ah, the Hebrew word, but it's not contained here. In fact, the word asah, the creative word, not the idea of something appearing. So he is basically reinterpreting and going against the details of the biblical text. And then in verse 17, we have another creative work or act, God placing them in the expanse or in the space or in the heavens. So I would reject that interpretation because it has to twist and reinterpret, insert things, omit things that are not in the biblical text. And therefore, I would say his scientific conclusion has some flaws in it. And I think there's other evidence that we can give that there's other flaws as well. And then in verse 19, there was evening and there was morning, a fourth day. So we have a concluding statement like we have in the other creative days. So that's kind of your introduction there. So we're going to look at day 5, fish and fowl, verse 20 through 23. And I reminded you from the very beginning in verse 2, the earth was without form and void, did not have a familiar form, a recognizable form, you might say. And there was an emptiness without form and empty or void, tohu vobohu are the Hebrew terms there. So God, in the first 3 days, is giving form, and he begins by giving light. In other words, it's something that you can now be able to visualize, form. And he's separating the heavens from the earth, so we're beginning to have form to the earth. and he separates the land and the sea so that the planet has something more recognizable to what we would expect even beyond the creation week. And then he begins to fill the earth with fullness, beginning with plant life. So he's populating plants or filling with plants. He's going to fill with heavenly bodies or lights. That's the word that the Hebrew text gives us, lights in the heavens. And now we're going to see on day five, he's going to fill the seas and he's going to fill the sky with creatures, birds in the sky, fish in the waters, if you will. So verse 20, then God said, let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. I should have highlighted, let God said. We've spent lots of time explaining that's not just an incidental text, it's an emphasis. In other words, God speaking the creation into existence. God speaks. We talked about the origin of language, etc. And what does he say? Let the waters teem with swarms of living creatures. In other words, simply speaking these creatures into existence. Well, what are these swarms, if you will? And what are these swarms of living creatures? Well, there's some Hebrew words that you can study there to give you some understanding. The word swarming things, sheretz, is the Hebrew word there, which most of you could care less. But for those of you that have a little bit of Hebrew, it's very interesting and it gets your attention, right, Maddie? Swarming things, sherets. Well, what are these? What kinds of creatures are these? Swarming, things that swarm or go in swarms or gather together. In the case of fish, for example, they swarm together. The same kinds generally stick together in swarms. So it would include fish and marine creatures of other kinds besides just fish. It could include amphibians, because we don't have a mention of amphibians in some of the other creative works that God does. So it probably includes amphibians that also tend to swarm. It could include reptiles. It could also include moles, for example, even land animals, mice maybe, and other creatures somewhat related that tend to swarm together. Insects, they also seemed to swarm. So it could include all of these, kind of a very broad category. And it also mentioned another interesting word, nephesh, which is very common in Scripture, living, and it could be translated, probably not in this context, but in other contexts, a living soul or a living animated aspect of a creature. The inward most important aspect of a creature. So nephesh occurs very frequently, 730 times in the Hebrew text, so very common, and very common even in Genesis. And it's the most important aspect of a creature. It's the one that animates him, gives him life. In fact, even choices are made, if you will, by creatures. Don't mix it up with soul, even though the same word is used, but in a different context when it refers to mankind. So animals don't have a soul in the same sense, but they do have this animating aspect, inward aspect within them. And it's translated living being, or in this case, living things, and in some context, soul, as I've mentioned already. So it makes a sharp distinction. Plants do not have nephesh. So we have a sharp distinction between plants and these first created creatures or animals. So examples that we could find in different realms, just a photograph to kind of keep your interest there. So let birds, a second aspect here, second major category, let birds fly above the earth in the open expanse of the heavens. So now we have flying creatures. I summarize it with fowl, fish and fowl, just to alliterate and make it simple there. If I had put flying creatures on there, it wouldn't fit on my slide, so I have to come up with a word that kind of fits the slide. So what are these flying things? The Hebrew word oph. And they could include all kinds of variety of flying creatures. We could name some of them. I don't have names on here, but it would include peacocks, even some animals that have gone extinct that are in the fossil record that show evidence of having wings, for example, and flight. And then the common birds that we're very familiar with. So quite a variety that God builds that are represented by flying creatures, kind of a major category. Now, already we have a conflict with evolution. If God creates all of these creatures all at the same time, we don't have this progress. We don't have this evolutionary movement over long periods of time. In fact, one of the contradictions is if, in fact, evolution were true, then you'd have to have flying creatures of four different distinct kinds of animals. You'd have to have four evolutionary paths, not just one, but four. Can you think of four distinct categories of flying creatures? Obviously birds, so besides just birds, what other kind of creatures fly? Okay, bats. Now, is a bat a bird? No. In fact, it's a totally separate category. It's a mammal. And it's totally separate from birds that are flying creatures. So we can include bats. Any others? What other creatures fly? Insects. And there's one before insects, the prehistoric a reptile that we find in the fossil record. Torosaurs fly. I think I gave you a photograph of a reconstruction of one there. And then we have insects. So you'd have to have four distinct evolutionary paths if evolutionary theory were, in fact, fact. If it were true that creatures evolved, you'd have to have four different ones. One is impossible and omitted by the biblical text, and now you have to have four different and distinct evolutionary paths. So there's no evolution, and already we've seen little evidence of no evolution. We've seen that life starts on the land rather than in a primordial soup. We've seen the immediacy of fulfillment. In other words, God creates instantaneously. No evolution, no long periods of progress. We've already seen the fixed nature of kinds. We saw that with plant life. And now we have it here when we have these first creatures, these flying creatures and swarming water creatures, after their kind, men. Remember, I made a big point out of the word men when we were talking about plants. We have the same Hebrew word here. In other words, there's boundaries between creatures that cannot be crossed, and they stay within their kinds, the fixed nature of kinds. Fourthly, we have very, very complex forms. Didn't start with amoeba or one-celled animals, but we have creation of total creatures after their kind. And we have to have four distinct flying creatures that we just looked at in the prior slide. So verse 21, God created the great sea monsters also on day 5. And I think Moses intentionally is kind of putting a little side note, if you will, when he mentions these great sea monsters, because a lot of cultures, probably based on legends and ideas that probably come from some reality, some of these cultures worship these large animals or these what they saw in the sea and other areas. So he created the great sea monsters. So lest you think that they come from gods or they represent gods, no, God created them, as large as they may be, as terrifying as they might seem to man. God is the one that created them. So we have another distinct category, kind of a separate one, calling attention to it. And I think because throughout cultures, people have tended to worship things that are not gods. So we have Tananim, a translation of sea monster. Now that's a translation. It could include other large creatures as well, probably a reference to dinosaurs. And it could include a variety of different creatures. Here's an example of two that are found in the fossil record. So they don't exist anymore. Well, where did they come from? And we see that on day five, God created them. And here's a couple of sea monsters, you might say. But we also have probably a focus on dinosaurs in general. So just calling attention to them. And kids wonder about dinosaurs. They're intrigued by them because of their size and the way they look. They seem scary, and it's interesting to young people. Well, I think the text is written just for kids as well, so they can see that God is the one that created dinosaurs. And also, not only the great sea monsters, and every living creature that moves. So now we have some other categories here. Every living, well, reference back to the living creatures or the swarming creatures. A repetition in verse 21. I'm jumping ahead in my thinking here. So every living creature, nephesh, and then we have the creatures that move or swarm, with which the waters swarmed after their kind. In other words, just an emphasis that God is the creator, repeating it in case you missed it the first time. And every winged bird after its kind, and notice its kind, distinct categories. And we have a divine evaluation. God saw that it was good. So it was good. In fact, it did not have probably predatory and destructive inclinations that animals have today. So very good, eventually. Very good in verse 31. And some contradictions. We have aquatic and flying creatures at the same time. That goes totally contrary to evolutionary schemes or thinking. We also have birds before reptiles. Reptiles are supposed to evolve first, and then eventually the last, or towards the end, would be the evolutionary of birds. But no, they're probably created at the same time, or the text at least seems to indicate that. And we have distinct creatures in terms of kinds, very, very distinct, even in fully developed organs. Bird lungs, radically different than reptiles. So there cannot be an evolution between the two. There's too much differences in the two. So we can add to our chart here. We've seen four flying creatures. Now we have mammals at the same time as reptiles. Again, outside of the evolutionary sequence. So don't try to impose, don't try to inject evolutionary thinking into Genesis 1, or you're going to have to do damage to the biblical text. In fact, go the other way and base your science on what the biblical text tells you, and let the science fall where it will. And if you come to wrong conclusions, then the biblical text is going to be corrective in terms of your conclusions. So we have flying with water creatures, same time, again, contradictory to evolution. Birds before reptiles, I mentioned that. And we have bird lungs, radically different from reptiles. So total contradictions here with evolutionary thinking. Verse 22, God blessed them, saying, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the waters in the seas, and let birds multiply on the earth. So God blesses them and has already built within them all of the capability, no evolutionary time again, all of the capability to reproduce, and the emphasis is reproducing after their kind, and now we have the divine encouragement, if you will, to fill the earth. Notice it's filling the earth that was initially without form and void. So there was evening and there was morning, a fifth day. So that's day five. Lots of science there. Distinction between plants and animal life. Secondly, aquatic and flying creatures created together. Birds before reptiles. Bird lungs different than reptile lungs, radically. Dinosaurs are in focus. Emphasis on dinosaurs. The fixity of kinds, again, reemphasized, just like we had it with plant life. And we have the origin of ichthyology and ornithology. Those are the sciences of fish and birds. So day six, we have land animals and man. So God is filling the earth now with more animals, different kinds of animals, and then eventually man. We won't get that far today. Then God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures, and notice a little phrase again, men after their kind. So we have the distinctions again, the emphasis going against the whole concept of evolution. Over and over, it's stressed. So let the earth bring forth. And we have living creatures, so creatures that have nephesh. I showed this slide already. So these creatures also have this animating life principle within them. Nephesh is the Hebrew word there. And also, after their kind, now we have other categories. Cattle and creeping things. These are different from swarming things that we saw earlier. Cattle, creeping things, perhaps actual cattle, even though the Hebrew word is a much broader term than just cows, much broader, includes others as well. Probably all domesticated animals, including sheep and goats and animals like that. And creeping things could be squirrels, turtles, things that kind of creep close to the ground. And all of the categories and all of the different kinds within these animals that creep. Broad categories on day six. And if we have domesticated animals before, beasts of the earth after their kind, this probably includes all of the wild animals. Wild animals. And notice again, it emphasizes after their kind. It keeps repeating that, emphasizing it. It's not a small matter. This is very, very important. So every time it occurs in the biblical text, it's just slapping the evolutionist in the face and says, no way. No way evolution after their kinds, distinct. Clear categories that are distinct from one another. So we have probably all of the wild animals that you can think of, giraffes, lions, elephants, etc. And you probably don't even have to go to Africa to see some of these. And it was so. So again, we have the emphasis. And notice we have the immediacy of fulfillment over and over again, emphasizing that this is radically different from 21st century thinking. And notice the stress, verse 25, God made the beasts of the earth after their kind, and the cattle after their kind, distinct categories. Notice the emphasis here, men, three times in this verse. And everything that creeps on the ground after its kind. Are you getting the message here? I think God knew, Moses, under inspiration, knew that in the 21st century we would be confused with these ideas of evolution from one species to another. And by the way, kinds are a broad category, broader than the species, because within kinds there's speciation, you might say, and we can verify that scientifically. But kinds are more in the area like a family. It'd be like the dog kind, and then within the dog kind, there are varieties, and God built within the genetic makeup the ability to have variation, such that you have distinct species within these broader kinds. Does that make sense? Dog kind, cat kind, horse kind, etc. So after its kind. Now, Paul was a very good, not only was he a very good astrophysicist, but Paul, because he knew the biblical text, he was a very good biologist as well, and zoologist. Notice in 1 Corinthians 15:39 to emphasize it. So this isn't just Genesis. This is reinforced by Paul in the New Testament. All flesh is not the same flesh. But there is one flesh of man, so man is distinct, calls attention to it. Another flesh of beasts, similar idea as what we have in Genesis. Another flesh of birds, another flesh of fish. So he kind of categorizes both days 5 and 6, at least the beginning of day 6, and emphasizes we have distinctions here. We have separate categories. They're different. The different flesh, different makeup, you might say. So Paul was a very good zoologist as well as astrophysicist. Remember, he talked about different stars and different heavenly bodies. And God saw that it was good. So we have the divine evaluation again, stressing that the creation day is different from later eras in Bible history. We also have contradictions, mammals and reptiles on the same day. And supposedly we have reptiles evolving into mammals, etc., but they're on the same day. So day 5, we have more on animal genetics. So just as we had animal genetics in terms of swarms in the waters and birds in the sky and botany and plants, we have more genetics in day 5, and in fact, it's stressed. We also have more on the fixity of kinds, the stress on it. And I've already emphasized that it's stressed over and over so that you don't get mixed up when you read a biology or a science text that emphasizes evolution. And we have more on zoology, the broad category that deals with animals in general. So we can add to our no evolution chart here. We have mammals on the same day as reptiles, or in close creative sequence there. And even the overall broad sequence of events, I introduced you to this first part of the chart and showed the inconsistency and the reason why you don't want to try to mix the two, why you don't want to impose evolutionary thinking on the biblical text, because you're going to have all these contradictions, at least in terms of time. And I've got kind of a sequence here of time, day 1, day 2, day 3, etc., day 4, 5, and 6. And the evolutionary, if you have a science text that emphasizes evolution, it'll lay out this sequence, a big bang. We said there's no big bang in Genesis 1. And they would put light as created early, or come, and they wouldn't say created, or evolving early from the big bang. And then we have stars, and then we have an evolution into galaxies and planets and Earth and oceans, and then the first cell, etc. And you can go down the list. We've already looked at some of that. But if you look at day 3, fruit trees, day 3, they don't come until way later in the evolutionary scheme. And on day 5, we have aquatic life, somewhat early, but still out of sequence. Flying creatures, way late. So notice how late that is in the evolutionary scheme, but at the same time as aquatic life. So a drastic inconsistency there. Sea monsters are included on day five. And again, they are much, much later in an evolutionary scheme. Domesticated animals, even later, but only a day later in the creation account. Creeping animals, also out of sequence. Wild animals, out of sequence as well. So there's no consistency here. Now, the only thing that's consistent is man is late in both. But there's a lot of inconsistencies there. We won't get to that today. So we can add to our chart. After the sequence events in verse 31 of Genesis, and God saw all that he made, and behold, it was very good. So a very good creation. Even a lot of scientists today are recognizing the problems, particularly in the area of genetics and microbiology. These are somewhat recent sciences that are catching up to what the Bible teaches. And the science of microbiology, I don't know, 100 years old. Does anyone have a time frame somewhere in there? So relatively recent in terms of study. And many of the evolutionists, even, who have believed in evolution, once they've gotten into the sciences of microbiology, cell biology, etc., on the genetic level, have come to some conclusions. In fact, there's an excellent book out by, I think he's still an evolutionist, but he sees the inconsistencies. A man by the name of Michael Denton has published a book in the area of microbiology, and he has a long conclusion and basically says, in fact, the title of his book, Evolution in Crisis. Evolution in Crisis, it says it all, because the evidence is just not there, and particularly in the microbiological realm. One of the sentences in his long conclusion, trying to argue that we got lots of problems in evolution, in all of microbiology, he calls it the myth of evolution. And this was written before 2000. I think it was written in 1980s, I believe. I'll have to go back and check. So when he states here, he says 20th century, that's when he wrote the book. And it's even more so after, 30 years of research, microbiology, etc., these sciences have just totally destroyed the concept of evolution. So you as a believer don't even try to harmonize evolutionary thinking with Scripture. He says, ultimately, the Darwinian theory of evolution is no more nor less than the great cosmogenic myth of the 20th century. And we could even add to the 21st century even more so. So evolution, now a lot of scientists are not aware of this. They're trusting in their training and haven't thought through a lot of these. But believers need to understand, when it comes to understanding truth, you have to go first to the Scriptures. That's absolute truth. And let that shape your thinking when it comes to scientific areas and scientific ideas. So we can conclude today. The creation, as we've seen from these 2 days of creation, displays God's infinite love. In fact, God is infinite in every way, in every aspect, and he has revealed himself. He displays infinite love in the variety of the things that he has created. And the variety of our Creator. He has great variety built into the creation. Therefore, we should worship him.